Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello, and thank you for joining us on MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, some clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. A warm welcome. I'm Jeremy Maggs. Coming up on the program today, troops on the streets, President Ramaphosa's 54 million rand army gamble, the new rules that could make or break South Africa's energy future, profit versus purpose, can big business really fix inequality, and is South Africa losing the war on illegal gambling? It's Tuesday, the 7th of July. Now, you would have heard President Ramaphosa has deployed over 3,400 SANDF soldiers nationwide on standby until the end of this month. Why? Well, to back up police at the anti-immigrant marches sweeping the country, protests that organizers are vowed to repeat every Thursday. I think this raises a very pointed question. Is this a necessary show of force or a sign that the state is losing its grip on public order? I want to discuss this with Dean Wingren. He's been with us on the program before. He is a defense analyst. So, Dean, deploying something in the region of 3,500 soldiers, does it say South Africa has a policing capacity problem or a political panic problem?
Hi, Jeremy and the listeners. And yes, it definitely does point to a policing capacity problem in that despite the police budget being double that of the Defence Force, they still rely on the Defence Force to make up numbers and to put feet on the beat, as it were. And I think it is quite prudent for them to use the Defence Force in this particular instance, in that we saw what happened in July 2021. And how the riots there just got completely out of hand. So this is good that at least the police and the presidency is taking the threat of violence seriously.
Dean, couple of worries, and let me indicate one that I'm concerned about. The letter from the president says troops are there for, and I quote, any eventualities. That seems to be a little bit vague. What does that phrasing actually authorize them to do on the ground?
Well, I think we must differentiate this particular notice to the general Operation Prosper notice that came out in March this year, where the Defence Force was also authorised to assist the police in illegal mining and gangsterism. So in that particular scenario, which goes until March 2027, you know, it's the active involvement of the Defence Force assisting the police. This particular operation for against any potential, as you say, eventualities related to the immigration marches is very, very specific to only for the month of July. And it appears that Defence Force will only be used as a backup. So the presidency does use, you know, any eventualities as a catch-all phrase. But I think they're not entirely sure themselves exactly if something will happen, and if it does happen, what. Mm. So they're keeping it open that if you just need troops to protect government buildings, that can be used for, or if they need to call in the Air Force to provide mobility with the few helicopters it has, to put troops around and put stopper blocks on various arterial routes, it can do that. So they're not themselves, but I don't think it's as sort of nefarious as what some people are making it out.
But we'd be right, surely, to raise a question about that word backup. Let me tell you why it would concern me. Soldiers are trained for combat, not crowd control. What happens, Dean, when training or when that specific training meets a chaotic street protest, for instance? Is there not a disconnect in perhaps operational discipline?
That goes back to the original request for troops to go into townships for anti-gangsterism and so on, and also to use them against illegal miners, in that this is not what the Defence Force troops are used for and trained for. But, you know, it is part of the Constitution that they can be used internally to assist the police. But it certainly is a worry that they could be untrained and not suitable for that. And that is why I try to draw a bit of a distinction between the normal Operation Prosper task, where they're actively involved, and in this particular instance, where they will just be used where there is sort of a crisis getting out of hand. But yes, you are right. It is a worry that the troops, I'm sure most of them will be reserve force as well, would not have been properly trained in in the civilian way of dealing with threats.
I guess there's also the issue of optics. Soldiers on the streets against a backdrop of anti-immigrant sentiment. Surely it could risk being read as the state taking sides rather than just keeping order.
Yes, there certainly is an amount of that, and optics is very important. And I think that is why sort of the president said in his letter, you know, that it'll be on standby, in that they, or certainly from my point of view, they shouldn't be the primary force out there regulating them and overseeing the marches. They should very much be in the background, confined to barracks, and only when there's a very real possibility of something happening that the police themselves cannot contain, should they then be relied upon. But yes, it is certainly would not look good for uniformed Defence Force members being the primary control of these marches.
And that's critical, because there's a real risk here of scope creep, because a standby deployment surely could quietly become a default response to any protest that government might find inconvenient.
And not only in this case, you know, we've seen it from prior years as well, in that the Defence Force is now being heavily relied upon to assist the police. And, you know, after many years of trying to keep troops out of the townships purely because of the optics of from the apartheid years of troops in townships, you know, it just seems that the police capacity to put a finger on crime and so on has just fallen so far down the hole that actually it's the last stop gasp now, almost, to use the Defence Force to assist them.
And just finally, we've got to worry about money. As I understand it, the deployment costing over 50 million rand runs until the end of the month, as I referenced. Organisers say they will march every Thursday, but what happens on 1 August if the protests haven't stopped? The cash register keeps ringing, doesn't it?
Yes, well, the president would have to reauthorize the deployment for that purpose. But the estimate of 54 million rand is just that. It's an estimate. And it's just what it says. If the troops are called upon, this is what the cost could be. But from the defense viewpoint, is that this is unfunded additional expenditure from a budget that is already underfunded. And the Defence Force itself, you know, can't be too happy about being called upon once again to do things out of their own meagre budget and hope at some future stage that there be a supplementary appropriation.
Dean Wingren is a defence analyst. Thank you very much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, government wants private capital to power South Africa's energy future, all well and good, but the fine print, might be scaring it away. NERSA, the regulator, is finalizing the market code and trading rules that, as I understand it, will govern the new electricity market, with Eskom, though, threatening a judicial review. So I guess the big question is, South Africa building a bankable market or potentially strangling all of this at its crib? James Beattie is with me now. He's the Chief Executive Officer of N Power Trading and also a member of the South Africa Energy Traders Association. James, welcome. Your headline message is get the rules right or lose investment. So concretely then, what investment, how much and how fast would it walk if NERSA gets it wrong?
Hi there, good afternoon. And first of all, thanks very much for hosting me on the program. You're absolutely right. I think we are at a critical juncture now after multiple years of formulation of the future market, where implementation is absolutely critical for us to capture all the progress that has been delivered to date. I think you would have seen in our article that was published online, also via SAITA, that around 8,000 megawatts worth of electricity has actually reached, or projects have reached, financial close as a result of the private market in the last year or so, which includes, of course, energy traders as off-takers. So these are meaningful numbers, and all of the progress that the opening up or liberalization of the market is now coming to bear has now anecdotally been delivered and is shown in the market. So it's so critical now that these rule sets, both the market code, which will govern the future SAWEM, the South Africa wholesale electricity market, as well as the bilateral trading market, are delivered, you know, and implemented correctly. So, you know, coming back to your original question, I think if we look at just the last year, we've seen 8,000 or so megawatts. That's billions and billions of dollars and rands worth of capital that has been deployed via the private sector to allow for all these projects to be constructed, alleviate load shedding, facilitate customer choice. And that's just looking in the rearview mirror. Yeah. So, you know, if we're talking now about the future and the market code, as well as trading rules, which will govern bilateral trading, if those aren't implemented now correctly, what we're worried about is a calcification of sorts for our forward curve. And so, you know, all the progress will just calcify and potentially result in a plateauing of the future and inefficiencies, higher costs to customers, as well as less customer choice. And that's really the biggest concern. So, you know, looking forward, it's obviously, in our view, a choice between multiple billions of rands worth of capital deployed versus, you know, a stagnation. Hard to pin down an actual number for you, I guess. But if we're looking historically at 8 gigawatts in just the last year, this could be, you know, in the order of tens of gigawatts worth of projects that may not reach financial close or reach the marketplace.
James, I understand your concern about stagnation or calcification, but if the market code had broad support at the July 1 hearing, in other words, if most of the industry backs it, why should we be worried at all?
There are, I think we need to split apart the two different, you know, regulatory legislations. The one is, of course, the market code, which is to govern the SAWEM, essentially. It's the operating framework for the SAWEM. The other one is, as I mentioned earlier, you know, the trading rules that will govern, you know, the in parallel bilateral trading space in South Africa. So I think you're absolutely right, Jeremy. It's important to segregate those two. The market code to date has been far less controversial. There is, to your point, you know, broad support for that. And to be clear for those listeners not, you know, in the details day to day, the market code is essentially the operating framework for the future wholesale market. So on-screen based electricity trading, where large industrial users, consumers, independent power producers will be, you know, accessing each other's trade via the SAWEM, the South Africa Wholesale Electricity Market. And that has, to your point, Jeremy, reached a lot of, you know, right, almost finality and is less controversial. What is now under a lot of discussion, and there is controversy still in the market, well, mostly most of the controversy, is the trading rules to govern what South Africa has seen pretty much to date, the bilateral trading space. And
So,
what do I mean by that? Well, I'll stop there.
no, well, let me ask you a question about the trading rules. If they restrict competition in bilateral trading during the first two phases, as I read it, surely some restriction is reasonable while the market is still finding its feet.
That is absolutely correct. I believe that most stakeholders wouldn't dispute what you've just mentioned, which is it's reasonable to have a level of phasing. That has also been, the standard practice in other markets that have opened historically. Of course, each market is unique. South Africa has the benefits of looking at reforms that have taken place over decades in alternate, in more developed markets. And so theoretically, that should speed things up. But with that being said, your point stands that it's reasonable to have it phased. I think everybody agrees. The real difficulty is at what balance? Because of course, if it's too slow or there's too much, let's call it stronghold on protecting incumbency, you may not have a bankable, investable environment fast enough. And I'll give you a real world example. There are many companies in the country, IPPs, trading companies, and others that have, large funders and backers behind them, looking at projects, looking at their financial models, looking at forward curves. Everyone's trying to project, an investable future. And if overnight there's a large delta between what actually gets implemented and what the market has been expecting over a very long, period of consultation, that has a lot large
Right.
ramification for investability.
James, very quickly, because I'm out of time, but NERSA says both frameworks land in August. Realistically, given Eskom's legal threat, surely you don't believe that date is going to hold.
I don't believe it will hold. I think you're right. I think realistically there will be back and forth debates. I expect Q1 27 is a more realistic horizon for finalization, but the big problem and question as well is that time is costing the markets and the country because uncertainty does unfortunately come with cost.
And if NERSA finalizes rules that traders, in other words, your organization, consider unbankable, what's your next move? Litigation.
I think, frankly, there will be a strong industry response. Both from Saita, our own company will have to look at its situation, to your point. I do think it would be a great sadness for the country and limiting the significant progress to date. That's a personal and company view. But yes, I think it strong pushback from industry, strong pushback from the public. We need to get this right.
James Beattie, thank you very much indeed. He is the Chief Executive Officer of Npower Trading, also a member of the South Africa Energy Traders Association.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, should companies also be judged by the jobs they create, the skills they build, and the communities they support? Or does that too easily sometimes become part of the corporate image machine? I want to talk about KFC Africa's inaugural impact report, and I think it puts that question squarely back on the table. In that respect, Andra Nell is with me, KFC's People, Purpose, and Culture Director, and I want to discuss what the report says and what sits behind those numbers. Andra, welcome to you. KFC, of course, is a commercial business. So let's start with this. What would you say to people who may see an impact report like this more as reputation building rather than real social contribution?
I completely understand the skepticism, and as a society, we've grown to question when people put out reports to that, and we welcome that, by the way. What we believe is that KFC is a incredibly successful business and has showed continued growth over the last 55 years. And we're not going to change our focus from making sure that we're a commercially sound business. But what we believe has been a part of our success is our focus on creating impact beyond the bottom line. Because when we do that, we know that we have this opportunity to invest into people. And we've proven time and time again that when people grow, impact multiplies. And that has leaned into the success that we've had as a business as well. So it's not a byproduct of our success. It is actually an integral ingredient.
I understand that, but how protected is the social investment? For instance, if the trading environment suddenly becomes tougher, in other words, is this ring-fenced or does it depend always on your business performance?
So it doesn't depend on our business performance. I'll give you an example. Our contribution that KFC makes to Ad Hope is a fixed percentage. It'll never, waver based on business performance. What we believe, though, is that if we do not invest into sustainable initiatives that make good business sense but are also good for society, businesses are just going to stop doing it when it gets tough, when profitability becomes a challenge, when the commercials become a challenge. So, as an example, even our packaging, et cetera, we spend a little bit more time making sure in the R&D phase that the packaging we bring in is good for the environment, but it also has a good business case behind it to make sure that we don't stop doing good when, the going gets tough and we regress in our progress. We actually bake it into the success for us as a business. So, to answer your question really directly, no, it's actually not. None of our levers are, condition of the business performance.
How do you bake it in as an organization, to make sure that it becomes ingrained and entrenched within your organization, given often that your operators within the company might also be worried about profitability, production, and broader commercial success?
I think it's a common thought process throughout the organization. I'll give you an example to our employment practices and how we develop talent within the organization. If you are purely developing talent so that you can tell the story about it, it becomes optional, in your business process, but we've actually baked it in. So I'll give you an example. Experience management for us, it starts with the employee because what we realize is that customer experience will never exceed the employee experience. So what we do is we don't add these as add-ons or nice to haves or whatever it is. They're actually integral ingredients. So when you're considering how we do it, part of the impact consideration then is obviously there's a bottom line impact, but at the same time, it's going like, how do you design this for the greatest possible impact? How do you give people more opportunities? How do you, give the employee additional benefits that allow them to continue to, build their livelihoods outside of KFC, acknowledging that people are not just people that serve the world's best fried chicken. They are also people that eventually like take care of families when they go home. So that is really part of our thought process and how we show up as a business.
There's always the danger of you being a victim of your success. For instance, if some of your graduates leave, do you still regard that as successful because the skills remain in the broader economy?
So we absolutely do. And I think we had to accept upfront that if you get somebody to get a degree through the Streetwise Academy, there's a very real chance that they might then, decide to pursue a career and opportunities elsewhere. What we have found is that retention rates are probably at their highest that they have been because people believe they've got a career here. But for us, it's not around, just creating the benefit for KFC. We know that there will be benefit to us while the employee is with our business, but we ultimately want them to be able to provide for their families. And by giving them these qualifications, we know that they now have access to career paths that they didn't have before. And that might be in our business or outside of it.
One of your headline claims is that every restaurant supports around 100 indirect jobs. Maybe explain to me how you define an indirect job and how that figure is calculated.
Absolutely. So there is a there's actually an industry standard around the QSR space and the number of jobs that are unlocked with every new store that opens. Because what we realize is a lot of people see our stores and they think that's where the KFC journey starts. But long before that, there's a farmer planting the lettuce, growing the chickens. There's a whole supply chain of delivery drivers, and then even beyond our restaurant, there are your last mile delivery partners, et cetera, that, get a job and an opportunity as a result of the KFC. So the numbers calculated based on an industry standard that has been calculated using various QSRs as a base. And what we've seen that time and time again is that continues to multiply as we expand across Africa. Obviously, there's a slightly higher creation when you're just establishing a supply chain, but obviously then it averages out as the supply chain matures.
And just a final one, you are encouraging other businesses to look at this model. Do you see this as preparation for a future maybe where corporate accountability becomes more formalized? Because let's be quite honest, in South Africa, in many cases, that is sorely lacking.
It really is. And I think the reality is there's always this risk that business gets drunk on the idea of purpose, and that kind of takes the lead ahead of making sure that we deliver sustainable business results. But what we do believe is that there's this incredible opportunity available to corporate organizations to not just, provide success in their own corner of the world, but that you actually create broader impact, and it's not at the cost of success. It's actually accelerated, and that's been true in our story repeatedly.
Andrew Nell from KFC, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, illegal online gambling has become a multi-billion rand shadow industry operating largely beyond South African regulators' reach. Now, the law says it's prohibited, but enforcement says otherwise. So is there a legislative gap here? Is it a political will problem or simply a case of outdated tools? I want to talk now to Sean Coleman, who's Chief Executive Officer of the South African Bookmakers Association. Sean, welcome to you. And your organization is concerned. You represent licensed bookmakers who compete directly with illegal operators, as I understand it. How much of this concern of yours is a push for public protection, and how much is just about protecting your members' market share?
Good afternoon, Jeremy. Thanks very much for having me. I think upfront, I think it's a combination of all of those factors, all which fall then into a melting pot, and we sit with, you know what, I think we are realistically calling an existential crisis. I mean, a 50 billion rand is leaving our economy, not generating any taxation or going into the economy. I mean, it is a serious concern. And I think then to answer directly on the question of public protection and protecting our own market, I think it's both. As a regulated market, we do subscribe to responsible gambling. We contribute levies to the Responsible Gambling Foundation. Our members do through licensing conditions and regulated contributions. And that public-private partnership has been has been going on for over 20 years. And then insofar as, yes, we do as regulated licensed operators in terms of our members want our market protected, from outside activities that are illegal. We have the ability to generate the taxes locally, and that then cascades down into provincial economies because licensees are registered by the non-provincial right. gambling boards. So they pay a provincial gambling tax. And that is used in provincial budgets, which go into local municipalities, and all of that cascades down into service delivery and all of the other things that are quite topical at the moment with the elections coming up.
But so, Sean, your proposed solution here is blocking with judicial oversight built in. I understand what you're saying, but realistically, how long would that legislative and court process actually take in South Africa? I mean, it's a long game, isn't it?
Any legal process can be long, we've met with the National Gambling Board as a stakeholder, and we've put some proposals on the table. I also think that as a country and as an industry, I don't think there's too much opposition, to advancing the legislation framework and actioning these items. And the National Gambling Board have recently just put out a proposal for service providers to submit proposals to provide a service to block this. But I mean, simple minor amendments to the National Gambling Act, which will give it an extraterritorial application. The FICA Act, even the Electronic Communications Act, just need small amendments in our view. And even the Films and Publications Act, where influencers and affiliates in terms of advertising are directing traffic offshore to these illegal sites, those types of things could be made illegal. We think that these are real tangible proposals, and with little or no opposition, public participation processes should be fairly slick, and we could move quite quickly. Of course, we're conscious in terms of the policy position that ISPA has taken with regards to your constitutional right to freedom of information and various other things. But there is an illegal market out there, and we think that we can achieve that.
Let
Of
me
course,
pick
there's no
you
silver.
let me pick you up on moving quickly. You might want to move quickly, but offshore operators can do exactly the same. What do I mean by that? They can switch domains, as we know, within hours. Sean, doesn't that make blocking a permanent game of almost whack-a-mole rather than trying to fix it?
Yeah, whack-a-mole or Tom and Jerry is the reference that I use, because in the cartoon Tom never catches Jerry, as we know. But there are slightly more nuanced approaches, things like web filtering, where you've got service providers out there that work with the telcos, work with the ISPs, and through a filtering system where you and I type in a URL to access a particular website. That website request goes through a filter. That filter is attached to a legally licensed database of regulated operators. And so if I'm attempting to get onto an illegal site that's not registered in South Africa, like 1xbet.com, and type in that URL, and it presents through the ISP and then into the service provider who's got a filtering database, and it doesn't connect with the database and register as a licensed, legally regulated operates in South Africa, it won't resolve to that domain name, to that URL, and accordingly, then you'll get a message on your screen to say you're attempting to access an illegal licensed operator outside the jurisdiction of South Africa, and your request is denied in terms of section so and so and so and so of the legislation, and that way, quite quickly. The whack-a-mole becomes a bit more tangible, and I mean, we're not foolhardy to think that we're going to eradicate access to the entire legal market, but there's a lot of inadvertent players who may be scrolling through their phones and get drawn into an advert, and then you click through, and all of a sudden you find yourself on a website that's called springbokcasino.com, and it's got absolutely nothing to do with South Africa. In fact, they're licensed in Curacao, and they're an illegal operator taking the gambling rand out of this country from people who are inadvertently playing. And if we could get 50% of the market back through inadvertent play, of course, anybody who has an intention to go and hide themselves and tunnel in via a VPN and stuff, those are not really the people that we're looking to try and get hold of at the moment, but more so the inadvertent players, and also to create education and awareness around this.
Sean, as I understand it, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, your plan also leans, and you've already referenced FICA and the Reserve Bank, but none of that touches cryptocurrency payment. How would your strategy deal with crypto-based betting?
Yeah, look, that's a new hot potato that certainly the FRC have been dealing with. I know that they've got some policy framework that they've recently published, with some regulations which are the subject of intense scrutiny and pushback from some of the crypto operators. And largely that would fall in that basket. Ultimately, the second strategy is a payment limitation strategy, but of course, crypto sits outside of the banking sector, so that's a difficult one for us to grapple with, and for the industry and the regulators as a whole to grapple with, because the nature of crypto is such that it doesn't leave a trail, but the well, a trail as we know it in terms of the banking sector anyway, but with the latest amendments that the FRC have promulgated. I think they've got something of a handle on that, and we'll be able to track those transactions if need be.
Just a final question. You cited that figure of 50 billion rand going offshore. I'm interested very quickly to know how you got that figure, and what is the actual loss to the bookmaking community in real terms?
So the 50 billion that was estimated was done. We commissioned a report by a reputable overseas firm called YieldSec. They do a lot of work in the space of tracking the illegal market with technology that they have. We were able to determine the extent and the size of the market that was impacting South Africa. So it's a published report using technology that they offer. And as I say, have worked with other regulated markets, and that's the figure that they extrapolated and pegged against the clicks and the tracking that they did over a period of time.
And the losses to your constituency?
Well, to the betting industry online, because only the betting industry is online at the moment. You have land-based casinos, but they're not online as yet, although some of the casino operators hold bookmaker licenses. It's 50 billion in GGR. So that's gross gaming revenue, that's gross profit, gross margin that is being taken out of this country, out of the industry, out of the economy, and out of the tax contributions. Because you must remember that also from a national perspective, gambling attracts VAT. So when you put 50 rand on a bet on the July, on a horse in the July, that's deemed to include 15% VAT.
Well, sadly,
so there's a national loss as well.
Sadly, Sean, my horse didn't come in, but thank you very much indeed. Sean Coleman, Chief Executive Officer of the South African Bookmakers Association. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.